If one loses 10 children through disaster, does the blessing of an additional 10 children at the end make for a happy ending to the book of Job? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author, as we begin a new series on the book of Job. My conversation partners are Dave Thomas, Dean of the Walla Walla University School of Theology, and Jen Ogden, Associate Pastor of the Walla Walla University Church. I want to thank you both for participating. Let's come back now to that leading question. Book of Job goes through, you lose 10 kids, get 10 more. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, getting 10 new children does not give you back the 10 you lost. And so while I think there would be some, certainly some joy again, it would not erase the sorrow.
No.
Yeah.
It would not erase the sorrow. But why do you start with that question, Alden? It's a hard question.
Well, our principal contributor to the official study guide wants to focus at the end. And I think he has a good point there that when you come to the end of the book, while there is some restoration, it's a long ways from being full restoration. And that's one question that comes to mind. You can't simply wipe away 10 kids and replace them with 10 others.
Yeah. And I think the question implies that there should be joy in the end despite the journey. Yeah. And I think sometimes the journey is just hard and depressing and the wrestling. And it doesn't mean that there's not good in the end, but it doesn't mean that the journey has been wonderful.
In fact, I read last week that a statement, something like Christians have always believed that life on this planet will not necessarily be good, that the good life comes after your experience on planet Earth, not during.
Jesus said something about that. Sufficient unto the day is it?
Yeah, he also said, in this world you will have tribulation. Be of good cheer.
Good.
Yeah.
Now, as we come to Job, this is the first lesson of the quarter, and I think we need to spend just a little bit of time sketching out the structure of Job. So I will do that briefly, and then I want to ask two questions that are, I think, important ones. One has this question of the role of Satan, because Satan only appears in the two heavenly scenes in the prologue. And the other one is the question of the resurrection, because there's a passage in the book of Job that has been taken by Christians to point to the resurrection, even though in the end, Job dies an old man full of days, period, without any reference to the resurrection. So we'll come back to those. But first of all, a bit of a sketch on the structure. In the prologue, you have five scenes, one on earth, one in heaven, then one on earth, one in heaven, and back on earth. Satan appears only in the two heavenly scenes. First man, he's a devout and wealthy man. He prays for his kids. And then you go up to heaven, and he is there, and the Lord asks him what he's up to. Well, wandering to and fro on the earth. Have you seen my man Job? Well, yeah. You bribed him, of course. See? So the Lord gives him permission to touch his flocks, which he does. Second scene up there, God kind of almost popping his button says, have you seen my man Job? He still holds fast to his integrity, even though you have moved me against him without cause. Well, I'll get a little bit closer and see what happens. Okay, just don't take away his life. So that's the setting at the beginning. Then you have three cycles of debate where Job's three friends come to comfort him, and it's strange comfort. they speak, and Job responds. They speak, and Job responds. When you get to the end of that cycle, those cycles, then there's a young man, Elihu, kind of a strange character, who comes in out of nowhere. Job never responds to him. God never talks about him. But it's kind of a cushion there before the Lord comes in with two remarkable speeches, one right after the other, a quiz in which Job flunks 0 out of 88. And then
that's my favorite part of the book of Job, Alden, so you know.
It's
a great list of questions God asked him.
That's right. So, and then in the end, God comes and says, the friends, you haven't told the truth about me as my man Job has, so you better ask him to offer sacrifice for you and pray for you. And that happened, which is kind of interesting, because the nice things from the book of Job that we quote in church all come from the friends. And they're the ones that had to repent in the end. So that will be a bit of a tension as we go through the lessons this quarter. Now, let's talk about Satan. And we will have an opportunity to do a bit more of this as we come along. But Satan just occurs in the two heavenly scenes. That's all. See? So how much does Job know about Satan, according to the book? Only the reader and the author know about Satan.
Well, that's an assumption we make.
Based on the book.
Yeah, but the fact that something is not necessary, is not mentioned, doesn't mean it's unknown.
You can argue that, Brother Dave, if you wish.
I might.
But now I want to ask a question here. We know about Satan, but what kind of role does Satan play in your day-to-day life? How conscious are you of Satan? What difference does it make that we now know about Satan? The reason I ask that is that Satan's very important for my structure, but I discover that I don't pay much attention to him day by day.
Well, there are people who talk a lot about Satan.
Yes.
They see Satan behind every bush, every headache, every stub toe, every... You know, I mean, I've had some conversation with people that where I've suggested to them that their Satan is more powerful than their God. So you may not be very interested in him, but there are people who are. I speaking from my experience, I don't think much about Satan. You know, if I look at the whole corpus of the Bible, I have decided that he is a defeated foe. Mm-hmm. And that if I simply don't give him any play in my life, I'm far better off than spending all my time worrying about him. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That a single angel of light can send Satan running.
Yep.
And so I prefer to think about God and good. But I suppose I encounter him when there is temptation, when I face temptation, and when I see evil. Those are the two times that I think about him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think in times of perhaps great distress or great misunderstanding is when I think there's something else at play here. But I agree with you, Dave. I don't think very regularly like, oh, this bad thing happened. It must be Satan present. I think we wrestle with that as Christians, is how do we acknowledge God at work in a variety of situations, be they what we see as good or experience as good or not? And I think Job wrestles with that because there's not the presence, the physical presence like there are in those heavenly scenes in Job's life of an evil being. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true for us too. You know, I don't have people who show up in I don't know, the Grim Reaper costume or whatever, and sure, parade themselves around as being the evil presence. And yet there are circumstances that lead me to think there is something that is adversarial and something that is opposed mm-hmm. to godliness and good in my life. And so I think it comes, but it's not probably the prominent thought.
Yeah. And I would think also that in the work of ministry, you run into that too, is that when you run into people who are embroiled in brokenness and addictions and circumstances that are sometimes unimaginable, you wonder, how did they get there? Mm-hmm. What is it about the way life is constituted here that brings that about? And, you know, I can think of a number of times in my life when I looked evil in the face and had a profound sense that this is there's something behind this that is pretty ugly. Mm-hmm. And of course, I would attribute that to Satan and the evil he perpetrates.
For me, the perplexity probably was highlighted most when my parents were both killed in a single car accident. And in attempting to draw the line between providence and the demonic, I found it impossible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Found it impossible. There is an evil force there, but God is stronger. We'll have a chance to touch on this a number of times during the quarter, but mm-hmm. before the clock runs out on us, I want to address the other question. It's that famous verse in Job 19, 25, and 26. Now, we'll come to a whole lesson on this, so I don't want to spend a lot of time, but at least I want to highlight what the issues may be here. Now, in the NIV, it says, "I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand on the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God." Now, there seems to be plenty of evidence that Job didn't really grasp a resurrection hope. Now, it's very interesting as you get closer to the New Testament, when resurrection becomes much more of a viable option, the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament, when they translated the book of Job, they added this line. The Hebrew simply says, Job died an old man, full of days, period. But the Greek adds, and he will live again with those whom the Lord raises up. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a powerful impulse for believers to think in terms of once true, always true, that if it's true now, then it always has been. So we tend to read back some of the things that we now know from later ones. But in the Adventist community, there's a phrase that is very important. It's called present truth. And Ellen White commented once in context of the 1888 trusses, that which God gives his servants to speak today would not perhaps have been present truth 20 years ago, but it is God's message for this time. So in theory, you should be able to have an Old Testament without a clear resurrection and still be able to survive, shouldn't you? Do you think most of the saints would be willing to believe that?
See, I mean, what do you consider the first mention of resurrection to be in the Old Testament?
First clear one is in Daniel 12.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the first clear one.
Yeah, which is well on into the New Testament, yep. Old Testament.
Well towards the New Testament. See, yeah. And of course, in the Old Testament, just like Abraham, he lived on through his kids. See, it was much more of a corporate sense, where individual resurrection points much more to the individual person. Mm-hmm. So, now the question is, how do we help our more conservative members in the church come to that community where they can live with that? And I'll just tell you a little narrative here. We'll talk more about this when we come to the passage, but when I pointed out that this passage, the Redeemer passage, wasn't in the first instance a resurrection passage, but referred to the Goel, the Redeemer figure, or the Avenger, or the near kinsman. And Job was simply crying out for someone to vindicate his life right then and there. One of my students, a very bright, very devout student, simply said, the size of our preachable Bible gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Hmm. As if it's not everywhere in Scripture, you can't preach it.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
So have either of you had any experience? We only have a few seconds here, so you don't have to come up with a long answer. In fact, you better come up with a short one.
Well, I mean, I think the illustration that works best for me is the one of looking at mountains from a long distance and then getting closer. When you're far away, you don't see the depth and the detail, but when you get closer, you do. And I think that's the story of the Bible.
Yeah.
And I think that there is some ambiguity, and we don't know everything about God yet, but we get a fuller and fuller picture the more we get to know him.
That's right. Well, next week we will take the next session where we talk about the great controversy, a broad scope thing. I want to thank Jen and Dave for their assistance, and my thanks to Jared Miller, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.